Today's episode is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace is the easiest way to create a beautiful website, blog, or online store for you and your ideas. Squarespace features an elegant interface, beautiful templates, and incredible 24/7 customer support. Try Squarespace at squarespace.com and enter the offer code PEL at checkout to get 10% off.
This episode of The Partially Examined Life is brought to you by St. John's College Graduate Institute, offering discussion-based master's degree programs for Western liberal arts or Eastern classics. Go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI for more information.
Welcome to The Partially Examined Life's part 2 of episode 125 on Hannah Arendt, a very special episode taking place live in Pittsburgh at the Pittsburgh Continental Philosophy Conference. In part one, we talked about, among other things, the difference between labor, that which we have to do to survive on a daily basis, and work, which actually creates something that lasts beyond us. And we talked about this ideal Athenian state where the public, as exemplified in the actions of Athenian democracy, and the private, which was indicated really by the physical space of the house and the household, was more or less self-contained, how that stuff had eroded over time, the difference between them had eroded, the richness of the public life as political action had degraded, and what replaced it all was the social, wherein the economic sphere, which used to be confined just to the household, according to Arendt, expanded, and really that's what government is all about now, is dealing with sort of public national housekeeping. In part two, we're going to talk more about the social and what's so bad about it, given that a rich human life requires political action, it requires contemplation, it requires a rich private life, etc. So enjoy.
So there's another way to kind of characterize this is that in the modern world, when society completely consumes the public space, so we no longer have public space in the sense where we have free people acting, and it's almost entirely consumed the private space, except for intimacy that we talked about, then what happens is you have this emergent property that starts to dictate behavioral norms. And what happens is not only that we as individuals in that lose our ability to act autonomously, the more of us there are, the more that norm gets defined statistically, and the more if you make films, 7-minute films on Super 8 and then transfer to digital so you can edit, the more you're a deviation from that norm. You are abnormal, right? And what's also important is that then government ceases to be necessary because there are no more choices to be made. There's only behavior and norms to be administered. So this ties into the Eichmann in Jerusalem, because her whole criticism in Eichmann in Jerusalem was about the bureaucratic nature, how Eichmann wasn't some sort of evil person in the sense of some transcendent evil. He was a bureaucrat. And I think if you want to find a connection in this book to that, it's the fact that politics gets reduced to administration of normal behavior with the power of the sword, so to speak. And so that's the real danger. And what that normal is, it could be your laborer, it could be, you know, all those different, you could be Lockean, you could be Marxian, you could be any of these things. They all have the same symptom, which is they are dictating what you should be, and then it's being enforced, and you no longer have freedom in the true sense of the word.
Well, she talks about, so on page 46, that's where she talks about the rise of the social, turning everyone into basically laborers.
And job holders.
Job holders. Yep. And then she goes into this section where she basically talks about labor like it's this cancer, which is a weird way to think of it because it's life itself. So, for instance, it's life become cancerous and overgrowing everything else. So, let's see. It was as though the growth element inherent in all organic life had completely overcome and overgrown the processes of decay by which organic life is checked and balanced in nature's household. The social realm, where the life process has established its own public domain, has let loose an unnatural growth, so to speak, of the natural. And it is against this growth, not merely against society, but against a constantly growing social realm, that the private and intimate, on the one hand, and the political, on the other, have proved incapable of defending themselves. So, you know, I think in both cases, with both capitalism and communism, both of them are what she calls emancipations of labor in this sense. And that emancipation allows it to run roughshod over both the public and private spheres.
And she points to, in the next paragraph, to the developments in the technology of labor, like the vision of labor and the mechanization of labor processes, which actually accelerate this whole thing.
The division of labor she thinks of as a, once you take labor out of the household, making labor a public thing. The division of labor is inevitable once it becomes a public thing as opposed to a household.
And one of the things she points to, she talks about, this is part of her historical examples, that apparently in medieval time, in looking at how much time people spent working, that during the Industrial Revolution and the modern era, people spent way more time of their day laboring than they ever did before, even among slaves. That the push of production in that respect was historically extreme.
Yeah. So Marx's emphasis on labor as a path, I suppose, to authenticity, that's the objection.
Right. It's forgetting that labor is supposed to be laborious. By definition, that's what the word is, that it is toil. And why you should then say, this is my identity, is to be a laborer or something. That's confusing. That really, if you want to have that kind of affection for labor, put it toward work instead. Actually producing something that is meant to last. And you could see why there would be a disillusionment.
To be fair, Marx was actually thinking of being freed up to work as opposed to simply being alienated.
Making labor.
Right. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. So I'm not sure how she would respond to that.
Right. What else do we want to say about this difference between labor and work? I mean, some of it is just a matter of what attitude you have toward what you're doing. It's not even necessarily what you're doing. That even an artist right now, because we're less pretentious, we don't feel like, I'm creating a work for the ages. Everything crumbles to dust. Come on. That's one of the things that Christianity added to the soup, according to her, is this bashing it down to the notion of immortality that was in ancient Greece.
But there should be durability. Yeah. That's a characteristic of work.
Yeah, characteristic of work.
So you don't think the performance artists are producing a work?
Not according to what she's talking about. It's not a work.
It's merely a labor.
We appreciate your labor. Yeah, I mean, I think we have to broaden the notion of work, right, to get back to that idea that work is something that produces something of permanence. All that has to do is mean it outlasts you, right, in a certain sense. But the real issue
is... But it can't strive to immortality in the way that deeds can, right?
No.
It's the transition from mere labor to the striving for immortality.
Well, it's part of the world of things that comes up between and amongst us as a plurality. We have to have a world of things that we create, and then those condition us, and we have deeds and actions which can be immortal. Or we can live a contemplative life, and we can tack onto the eternal... Right.
And think about the good.
But the real issue, I think the really, really oppressive issue about making society about labor, when we say we are a society of laborers, is you're basically saying the whole purpose of life is survival, nothing more. If all you're focused on is labor, you're basically saying the only reason we exist is to survive, because you're taking out not just works of permanence and deeds and actions and immoral, but even anything else, anything creative at all. And that's what's really oppressive about it.
Your life is all about necessity. Which is not free.
No.
So what does that mean? Somebody who's laboring in a job that feels like labor, you could definitely see how this could be dehumanizing. She definitely wants to equally condemn people who are, a high-level business person spending all of his day doing this, that they're still ultimately doing this to make a living. Whereas I would feel, especially somebody who's an entrepreneur, the way they describe it, is that they're finding needs that need to be met, and they're coming up with innovative ways to do it and infusing capital here and there, and they're living some kind of meaningful life. She wants to say that's misinterpreting. They're not actually creating works. They're creating consumables in some way.
Well, I don't feel like she engaged that kind of activity very much in here. I mean, the picture of the laborer, of business and stuff, to me was one that sounded like very Marxian or Smithian, in it's a whole bunch of nameless, faceless people engaging in this activity. It didn't sound as much like she was engaging this notion of an entrepreneur that would be making a business and building a work like that.
I think I can answer Marx. I can give an account anyway from a book. She discusses the notion of wealth versus property, and how originally the idea of owning property was so you could generate wealth, but wealth is to be consumed. So that's the original Greek polis, right? They're not capitalists. They're not trying to produce more and more and more and grow. They're trying to sustain their household so they can have freedom to go have ship battles, right, with the Spartans or whoever.
Build a trireme.
The first phase of capitalism, where you have the first mercantile class and all that, and they say, we want to secure our property. We want the government to protect us and secure our property so that we can generate wealth, with the idea still that there will be consumption. When property is designed to generate the acquisition of more property, that's when capital's purpose is to beget capital, not wealth to be consumed. And that's
So these people who are entrepreneurs and they're like, hey, you know, I'm going to go on Shark Tank and I'm going to get funding to, you know, have this bed that kids can't roll out of because the sheets tuck in or whatever it is, right? On the one hand, they're trying to get wealth that they can consume because everybody wants to drive a Lexus or whatever. But I think on the other hand, they're trying to generate capital. Like that's the whole system. It's just beget capital, begets capital, begets capital with no purpose or end in sight. And to that extent, they're caught in the same matrix, I think, as the labor.
But again, one of the common things is just the way in which all of these items become fungible one into the other. So money is the problem
here. She talks about the social evaporation of the tangible in this context, right?
Yeah, everything becomes the same in some way. So it loses its integrity.
It becomes the same because it becomes a question of what its monetary value is. She mentions at one point that admiration has no value anymore unless it can be turned into dollars. It used to be that reputation, shame were things that were important. You cared about your reputation, and nowadays it doesn't matter. It's just how can you turn it into money.
Yeah. Again, though, I think our objection is the sense in which we lose the sense of public and private through this, because this evaporation of the tangible deprives the world of what she calls its worldly character, and we need that. This is section 9, page 70. So she's just gotten done talking about fungibility and even property being seen as something consumable.
And there are only 10 sections here. We're in the home stretch. Just so you
know. So let's see. Closely connected with this social evaporation of the tangible was the most revolutionary modern contribution to the concept of property, according to which property was not a fixed and firmly located part of the world, acquired by its owner in one way or another, but, on the contrary, had its source in man himself, in his possession of a body and his indisputable ownership of the strength of his body, which Marx called labor power. So I haven't really helped us there. Here it is, sorry. Thus, modern property lost its worldly character and was located in the person himself, that is, in what an individual could lose only along with his life. So it's no longer a founding element of the public realm. It's now,
it's a commodity. It's
in the same way that the private is shrunken into the intimate, property
is
shrunken into the individual in some sense. Yeah.
Yeah, that he talked originally about the property of the, you know, that was a requisite to becoming a participating member of the polis was your physical house. And in fact, if you got kicked out of the city-state, it would burn down the house. It wouldn't just, somebody wouldn't just take it. But that's how closely it was, like, that house is that family. And that provided a solidity. It provided you with a location, an emplacement in the society, physically as well as socially. And the fact that we've lost that, she seems to think, yeah, things are just becoming less real. That wealth is, you know, money is numbers.
We should talk about, because we kind of skipped this. This is section 7, this idea of
the property.
Reality is founded on the public. We,
yes,
you know, we lose reality in itself to some extent by losing the public.
So that actually is a different way of putting, you know, what's, why isn't the intimate, why isn't my encounter with one person enough? Is that enough to establish reality? You know, if you're in an intimate relationship, exactly how single-minded the two of you been connected hopefully can be, and how crazy you could meet a couple and you could talk to them and who are these people? They're out of their freaking mind. Like, they need a third person. They need a marriage counselor. They need somebody in the public to come in.
There's a quotation which directly addresses this. Compared with the reality which comes from being seen and heard, so part of this idea of the public is doing things in front of other people, being recognized. So compared with the reality which comes from being seen and heard, even the greatest forces of intimate life, the passions of the heart, the thoughts of the mind, the delights of the senses, lead an uncertain, shadowy kind of existence unless and until they are transformed, deprivatized, and de-individualized, as it were, into a shape to fit them for public appearance, which is to say, in artistic works. And that's what really one of the functions of art here is, to deprivatize these passions in an attempt to bring back the real. But that doesn't work, really. I mean, it approaches it, but it doesn't
work. Well, she ups the ante a little bit at the end, on the bottom of 57. Only where things can be seen by many in a variety of aspects, without changing their identity, so that those who are gathered around them know they see sameness in utter diversity, can worldly reality truly and reliably appear. So this is where our characteristic of us being plural comes to the fore. And that is the ground for things being real.
Yeah, so she's
shifted there. There is no reality.
For being a world in Heidegger's sense, we're not just talking about the planet that happens to exist, but the human world with its meanings.
Well, she's shifted there from talking about the need to be seen and heard to the need for an external object to which we give our joint attention.
So this is page 71. Reality is not guaranteed primarily by our common nature. It's guaranteed by having the same object on page 58. So if the sameness of this object can no longer be discerned, no common nature of men, at least not of all, the unnatural conformism of a mass society can prevent the destruction of the common world. And this is where she gets into this idea of needing all these diverse perspectives to sort of create that world or to maintain that world.
It raises an interesting idea in a polis of having a conflict in which you all got together and decided to deny the existence of something with respect to one other person. So it may be like the
you've decided that Seth doesn't exist anymore.
Yes, so we just don't talk about him at all anymore.
I think there was a Twilight Zone
episode. There is a Twilight Zone
where people just stop talking about somebody and he kind of disappears or something like that.
Oh,
yeah. Just the function of the common assent in the sense of recognition. She doesn't use that word, but that the things held in common are the things that are.
This is this is thematic to ancient philosophy. The idea of the having the things in common are this important ground, and we lose that. Yeah.
This spoke to me in kind of a different way. This is like one of my favorite parts of the book. So, to reiterate, just everything that appears out in the open is seen and heard by everyone. Reality individually experienced is fully realized only when it's deprivatized. Like, the first thing that came to my mind, of course, was Facebook, right? Like, I didn't have a meal until I've taken a picture of it and made sure that you guys know how pretty it was and where I'm at and all that sort of thing. And it's symptomatic that we, in the same way that we lost the private sphere of the household, where there was no sharing. What happened in the household was strictly in the household, and it's not like people went over to each other's houses and that sort of, that's the idea, is that this complete loss of privacy also means that whatever you experience in your inner life is meaningless until you share it with somebody else. Like, we don't even have a way of valuing our own experience. But there's a limit to that. And she mentions specifically, she says it's a testimony that there's a barrier because physical pain is the one thing that you experience in your body that you cannot share with the public. You can't post it anywhere. You can't tweet it. And, you know, it's that whole, what is it, Wittgenstein? Can you feel this pain? Right? You know, and I absolutely, absolutely love that section because it just so clearly, I think, sells the idea a little bit. For me, like, it's such a visceral kind of description of it, as opposed to the common constituting, you know. I guess the sense is, if we had a true plurality where we were sharing, that we would also regain our interiority, or at least the value of our interiority.
He just seems to go pretty far with it, you know.
So essential to the public is that there's always a new person can come along. So even if we've made as a group, we've decided that Seth doesn't exist and we're not going to pay attention to him anymore, then the little kid comes along and says, look, there's Seth.
Yes, exactly.
And ruins it.
An entirely new action. That's right.
Which implies a degree of openness to society that doesn't seem like it was in the polis. You don't just get constant new influx of people with their houses.
Well, she does start the book off by saying, you know, we're all the same and that we're all unique and, you know, we're all snowflakes. And she doesn't talk about gender or race impacting your snowflakeness or ability to be snowflaked.
Another aspect that it reminded me of was the activity of experimental science. The activity of common ascension, that you would do an experiment that everybody can see before them. And that has a way of presupposing the authority of each individual freely acting. And that it becomes a real and true account insofar as anybody can reproduce it. Anybody can see it happening. As opposed to something that was born out of just the authority that I said the way it was. You know, the king says, well, I can float off the ground or something. That you have to demonstrate it. It has to be a public act. And it becomes real in being that public act. And that's one of the founding tenets of modern science, modern experimental science. And the reason that I found that interesting is the extent to which the modern condition, modern science, has this leveling effect that she's going to criticize in the end.
But
because it seems to be deeply,
we're getting into the question of, you know, what kinds of things do we need to have in common, you know,
in order to be political,
not
in order to be free
stuff we're posting on Facebook. And she even talks about, for instance, it could be in the case of the conformism that you all have the same opinion, but that's not really having something
that you can communicate
having something
about
in common. You know, so it may also happen under the conditions of mass society or mass hysteria, where we see all people suddenly behave as though they were members of one family, each multiplying and prolonging the perspective of his neighbor. In both instances, men have become entirely private. So things that seem on the face of it public, like posting to Facebook or belonging to political communities in which everyone agrees with you, going to the same websites, reading the same sort of political tirades that
agree with you. That, in a way, is also a way of retreating to one's private spirits. It's actually isolating. It's not a way of being in a community with others.
Yeah, so. She says, even if you infinitely replicate the same thing, that doesn't make it common, right? But the irony of your example, and you know me, I'm always ready to beat down science, is that replication doesn't happen. I mean, we just saw the slew of reports about how 60% of research is never replicated, and nothing ever gets demonstrated. It's just published, and people don't even engage with it. They just let it hang out there, and then somebody picks it up and reports on it. So, again, not talking about in the ideal state, I'm saying symptomatic of the society where individuals are not engaged, where we don't have a common goal, where we're not expressing diversity about commonality, where we're not, you know, taking all these things seriously. That's a perfect example of how that manifests itself in that supposedly more pristine or regulated realm.
But the larger question, I mean, is does that count as one of the things we have in common, even though it's a good example? And I don't know the answer to that question. Does joint attention to a novel, for instance, count as having a thing in common? It's unclear to me what counts for her as these world-founding objects and what doesn't.
And what the relationship to freedom is. I mean, is it that you speak as a free human being about this thing that's held in common? And what's the sign that you're being free in that, right? Is it that you disagree or is that you agree, or the practical working out of it doesn't? How it, you can actually tell that it's happening or not. Because one of the conditions of society here is, it seems right, it's easy to recognize the kind of leveling thing that she's talking about, but it's not clear to me that how you would see it being different. How is the polis going to be manifestly different if I walk into it?
If you do some great deeds and have some great words, you're producing an effect there.
But how would I distinguish that from doing such a thing in society? That just because in society I would just never try to do great deeds?
So,
that
so
would
these
be,
last,
not be part of my discussion?
These last two comments sound... It's easy to read critiques
you
like
try
this.
To do great works. Sorry.
Right. To read high-level critiques like this as kind of snobbish and esoteric. Like, you're doing it wrong. You have false consciousness. And you might think that you have solidarity with your friends on Facebook, but you're doing it wrong. That's not real solidarity. Like... But she says things that make it seem like she's actually reacting to visible psychological problems in society. So loneliness being a main one of them. The bottom 58, top of 59. Under modern circumstances, this deprivation of objective relationships to others and of a reality guaranteed through them has become the mass phenomenon of loneliness, where it has assumed its most extreme and most anti-human form. The reason for this extremity is that mass society not only destroys the public realm, but the private as well, deprives men not only of their place in the world, but of their private home, where they once felt sheltered against the world, and where, at any rate, even those excluded from the world could find a substitute in the warmth of the hearth and the limited reality of family life.
She definitely thinks if you're in the public too much, you become shallow. If you think everything I have to do has to be posted on Facebook, it's not really real until I post it on Facebook.
Well, you need the private to retreat into to... It's without, yeah, it's
to think.
The public becomes shallow without the private counterbalancing. It's an interesting section because it's, you know, we thought it was just the decimation of the public realm initially that, you know, was the problem, but now it's this, she's spelling out this, the ways in which the
private are. Well, yeah, because there are two sides of the same coin, so if you get rid of one, you're really obliterating the other.
Right.
But I can say that out loud, but I'm not sure I completely understand that. And does anybody have any other insights from the text or... from your interpretation of this that made that actually make sense?
That the impoverishment of the private...
Of the public of the, means the impoverishment of the private.
Yeah. I was just going to say it in the other order, but that's what I was
saying. Well, it's really just the collapsing of the distinction between the two, right? The sense in which both are damaged is the sense in which they merge. Right? That's what society is. It's that merging of public and private.
Doesn't she emphasize the way that society is really the private overtaking the public? And it becomes public-like in that it's amongst many people, but it really is a symptom of the private, that is labor, overtaking all aspects of public life. There's an apparent symmetry between the two things overtaking one another, but it really is the private overcoming the public. The disappearance of the public in the face of the private, you know, the idea of rule being monarchy-based or household-based. The prevalence of economics as the way in which we understand our relationships between one another, the leveling of statistics to define who we are so that everything that in which she has this great sentence that says, identity is not about normative behaviors. Identity is about exceptional behaviors. And we've been somehow fooled or cowed into the idea that what is normal and normative is where the source of our identity is. And she wants to say, that's absolutely not true. It's actually our exceptional behaviors.
I'm trying to put some of this concretely into, like, right, what makes a good office environment or a bad office environment. That if you're...
No cubes.
You know, well, you're working alongside the people. You have your coffee breaks together or whatever, but you're basically, you know, you could see that that's a prime example where the loneliness that she talks about, like, would be rampant. However, maybe if you had a different management strategy and you let all your employees innovate and put together their ideas and they aren't just doing the same thing like call center employees in neighboring cubes, but that they're working together on a project to make something, to develop the software or whatever, and not just being code monkeys doing what they're told.
Rand is rolling over in a grave right now. So talking about bureaucratic and administrative steps to
yeah,
make the office environment more rent friendly.
I keep trying to think how the, you know, somebody who's really in favor of entrepreneurial capitalism and finding meaning through doing something that is of value to others. I've been listening to a lot of econ talk lately. So that's the way that Russ Roberts on that talks all the time, that why would you feel that something is meaningful? It would be retreating into your private, the privative privacy to just, I'm just going to stay home. And even if I'm doing art just for me or doing something that's just for me, that doesn't have, it's not going to be as meaningful as if you're actually putting something out in the world that is creating something, creating value, which then if you're an optimist about capitalism, you think probably you could get money for if you're creating something that's really of value to somebody else that they're going to buy it from you. So from there, it's just, you know, it becomes a matter of, yeah, you start thinking about engineering of how can we give this thrill that the capitalist has in doing these entrepreneurial activities to spread this out more widely so more people, you know, that's why it's
you're trying to make love
your job.
Non-elitist.
Love your job.
Elitist work.
It doesn't become, like, I always think that in order to really love your job, you'd have to quit your job because most jobs do not really admit of being loved, but no. We just need better management techniques. We need better attitudes of individuals.
Manage your way to freedom.
Own your own.
Manage your way to the polis.
So,
well, I'll force you to be free.
Let me say this: we probably should start wrapping up a little
we
bit
should.
Here. So, you know, Mark, just in response to that last point, the word value is painfully overused in today's discourse, particularly in the realm, right? And entrepreneurs trying to identify market opportunities and customer needs, and then we're going
to
create a solution, right?
Enhance
that
value.
Generate to enhance value and generate value.
You create the final solution.
And it's like you can. This is the kind of shit we have to put up with.
That would have been edited out.
But you know what? You could be a social. You could create a social work entrepreneurial solution that had no capital production goals as its end, right? You see somebody like Jonathan Sachs. He's got all the money in the world, right? So he's going to go fix Africa. So it's not about money for him. It's about something else. I don't know what it's about, but the point is that whole model of entrepreneurial value creation, when you take away the element of capital production, still doesn't seem to speak to...
Yeah.
It still doesn't answer the question. So there's a couple of things. We usually do summations or winding up. This will be mine, right? So I think there's a sense in which, as a solution to this problem of society, if we truly saw each other as equal participants and we recognized each other's diversity and welcomed it and empowered that and agreed on these things in common. I think when I was reading that section on things in common, I was thinking in terms of political discourse. So right now we have at least two extremes in our political system that can't even agree on what the facts are. They're no longer talking about same. Whatever their differences are, there's not even a discourse about the same. And there's a sense in which that's symptomatic of something that's radically, radically broken in the way our world is. So if we were able to say, we're going to agree that we're talking about X, I'm not you, you're not me, but we're both valid and we both have, you know, some legitimacy and all that stuff, that would be the first baby steps towards trying to recover some sense of free action. Another thing would be to start recognizing the importance of privacy and not in a romantic sense where we have to go off into nature to get away from everything, but truly take a look at how, as we broadcast over the internet, and our phones. I mean, have you noticed recently, like when you're just, my friend said he drove by a car dealership and like the next thing he knew on Google, the next time his browser came up, there was an advertisement. He wasn't even looking for a car. He just drove by it. And all of a sudden there's like, you know, I mean, we have to start taking those things seriously. Like not just because it's an invasion of privacy, but because it's a true erosion of your own ability to have, you know, your own private sphere in a certain sense, which is, as we say, critical. But the one thing, and I love this book. In fact, I'm going to read the rest of it eventually. I say that about Phenomenology of Spirit, too.
We'll just do another podcast on it.
Yeah. Is that it's kind of, she doesn't have a positive prescription for what, I guess we're supposed to self-determine what would be fulfilling or what would be free action for us. There's kind of something missing about the creative aspect.
There's a lack of concrete examples. Well, I explored the rest of the book in search of those.
Yeah, examples. There's plenty.
So, for instance, even legislation turns out not to be an action. It's a making. It's a poesis.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. And the other thing is we apparently should go read Proudhon. Because she quotes him about 75 times in this first section.
Proudhon.
I don't speak French. Anyway, so my Jean Shalit, right? Thumbs up. I definitely think you should definitely read this. I mean, it's fascinating and has a lot of really interesting ideas at work. There's a certain sense in which we can't validate the genealogy aspect of it. We don't know, you know, how true or just because Aristotle says things were this way doesn't mean the Greek society was actually that way.
It's one fragment of Heraclitus.
justification
for the law being a barrier between the, yeah.
All right, I'm sorry, folks. We got to take time out for just a second from our live Pittsburgh action and tell you about our sponsor for this episode, Seth.
Hey, Mark. Yeah, our sponsor today is Squarespace. I think you all know building a website can be tough, and even if you do know your way around coding, creating something that looks good and works well is a time-consuming affair. In this day and age, you definitely need a website, and fortunately for us, Squarespace makes it easy to build beautiful websites without breaking a sweat. I can tell you from my own personal experience and also from working on the PEL site, you know, when you use a platform that's just basically kind of a bare bones blogging platform or whatever it is, you're constantly searching for plugins that give you the functionality you need. You want to do e-commerce, you're going to sell stuff. You want to bring in images, you need stock images, or you're going to take your own photos or whatever. And so you end up having to go out and search for things on the web. You have to FTP and integrate them. And it's just, and you got to know code. You need a template, CSS, all that stuff. Squarespace is the complete opposite of that experience. Their website builder offers design templates. It offers images. It shows you immediately, gives you immediate feedback when you make changes, what it looks like. And you can do everything from within a very simple, intuitive, and consistent design structure. It's really, really fantastic and easy to use. And you can pick your template based on what you want to accomplish. So they've got ones that work if you're predominantly focused on putting together a store, or if you want to go ahead and put your portfolio out there, or whatever the case may be.
So it sounds like you could use it either for becoming a node within the social or putting forth your perspective in the egalitarian polis.
That is correct. Now, this is obviously something you would only use if you were functioning in the social or the public space, obviously not within the four walls of your ancient Athenian family compound. So Squarespace has all those tools you need to do the create, but that's also state-of-the-art technology underneath it. It's going to power your site. It's going to make sure it's fast, secure, reliable, that it looks great on any device. And you know you can trust Squarespace when millions of people and some of the biggest and most respected brands in the world trust them too. Seriously, you can't beat the ease and simplicity of Squarespace, and you get 24/7 support for only $8 a month. You'll even get a free domain if you buy Squarespace for the year. So start a trial today with no credit card required and start building your website today. Make sure when you do sign up that you use offer code PEL to get 10% off your first purchase and to show your support for the Partially Examined Life. Squarespace, build it beautiful.
And
this episode of the Partially Examined Life is brought to you by the St. John's College Graduate Institute. The Graduate Institute is the master's degree granting arm of St. John's College in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and Annapolis, Maryland. Most of you listening are dedicated to the thoughtful reading of and serious conversation about the greatest books ever written. The Graduate Institute attracts a community of fellows who are passionate about the life of the mind. All classes at the St. John's Graduate Institute are, like PEL episodes, discussions. The books are the teachers, and the faculty members are tutors who come together to learn as well. The Graduate Institute accepts applications on a rolling basis. There's no application fee, and the only requirement is a bachelor's degree in any field. In addition to degree-granting programs, the Graduate Institute at St. John's College sponsors summer educational opportunities, including a 9-week Ancient Greek Institute, an 8-week film studies program, and 2-week-long Science Institute programs. So, if you're a PEL citizen, fan, or even a casual listener with an interest in joining other like-minded individuals in a more formal, intimate setting to engage in the serious contemplation of great works of literature, philosophy, history, theology, mathematics, and science, check out the St. John's College Graduate Institute. For more information, visit partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI. That's partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI. Thanks to St. John's College Graduate Institute for their support of the Partially Examined Life.
All right, let us transport you all back to Pittsburgh for the conclusion of our episode 125. Thanks.
One point I'm not sure if we've completely made is by sketching out more about the Vita Activa, she wants to say that the contemplative life, it's not that she wants to turn it upside down and say that actually these active things are the only way. I mean, it's true. The only way to be fully human is to be engaged politically in this way. But still, the contemplative life is a part of it, is a part of the private sphere that needs to be nurtured as well. So she wants to just get rid of this competition between the two of them. They're both good. One part that we didn't really talk about so much here, it's in section 10, and then she mentions it earlier, but is the bashing that she has about medieval Christianity and Christianity in general. And in section 10, she emphasizes the contradictions involved in goodness, that you would think that goodness becomes like one of the most private things, because, you know, if you read Augustine, I mean, he just drives himself crazy about like, well, I'm trying to be noble and good, but then when I realize I'm noble and good, I feel pride about it so much. So the way Red puts it is, you know, a good deed, in fact, needs to be forgotten as soon as it is done. So like, pursuing goodness in this way.
If you do it in public, it could be that you're doing it for praise, but then you can't even acknowledge it to yourself. Yes. That's the thing. It has to,
Your right hand cannot know what your left hand is doing.
For it to be good. And so she concludes, no one can really be good. So.
Yeah, so you might have thought that the solution to all this shallowness in the world, society taking over, is to kind of take the Platonic way and stand before the eternal, the wordless. But that would be very lonely, she thinks. That's not enough.
Well, she says it's solitary, but at least you get yourself as company. In the case of doing good, right?
For being a philosopher. Being a philosopher, you do.
Right.
Yeah, a philosopher. In the case of doing good deeds, even though you're among people, you're the most isolated because good deeds actually aren't good company.
Yeah, and you can't even speak to yourself about them.
Yeah, exactly.
Because you have to forget.
Can't speak to others about them, you can't speak to yourself. So it's this,
a little bit
it's when you get rid of the speech element that you get total isolation.
Yeah. It seems a little bit of a gross caricature. To my part, but I enjoyed the dig. I enjoyed her debt to Nietzsche there.
Arendt doesn't like social justice. She doesn't like goodness.
And I agree with Seth. I thought this was one of the most fun readings that we've done in a while. She's known as someone, she was a student of Heidegger and Jaspers, and that she would take a lot of the ideas, at least that were descended from Heidegger, but actually talk about them concretely enough that you know what she's talking about. And that's awesome, that if this is what openness and the clearing of being amounts to, is having productive political encounters and an intimacy and an inner life and all that stuff, and that's what having a self and being authentic is about, that makes quite a lot of sense to me.
It has a great virtue of being utterly readable.
I have to admit, I'm still a little confused about what the political is.
Because
when I said, for instance, she doesn't like social justice, I read somewhere that at some event someone asked her about, well, what about, this is one of the big critiques of the book, what about distributive justice? What about social justice? And she said, those things are not political problems. They don't fall within the realm of politics. The political is not about necessity. So making sure the poor are fed and all those sorts of things don't rise to the level of the political for her, and it remains, because of the lack of examples, what the political is exactly does remain unclear.
Well, it would seem sort of some of the most salient political challenges over the past 2,000 years have been about the status of individuals who were relegated to the household in her way of talking about it. So being a slave, being a serf, right, status of women, all of those things which we would normally think of as political problems, it's not clear that she thinks of them as political problems. Now, maybe she would, you know, she would agree that you have to...
They are necessary conditions of the political, in fact.
Well, at least in what we read, and it's not clear how... She's talking about what the human condition is, but how to diagnose what we would do about making a more just society or something like that. That would be part of the conversation, the polis?
Yes, yes. The goal is the conversation. Yep. And once you have the conversation, you can work out that stuff. And I'm not going to, you know, she's not going to just tell you, prejudge that conversation.
No.
Yeah, but is it? But it's interesting political...
Because she's not a plurality.
Yeah, but it's an interesting political problem, because if you have a polis of free men, right, but the real problem is slavery, who is acting as the voice of...
Of the slaves, of the...
Yeah, I mean,
they can't be free without the slaves. That's the thing. I mean,
this is where the kinds of political problems that challenges we've had in the past seem to not be alleviated by the political structure that she's pointing to, simply speaking, unless you set it up beforehand where everybody is free in a particular way and you generate a society that's free in that way. But having society generate itself into enhancing that freedom, I don't see the path exactly to that.
Well, I think that there are pretty dark elitist implications to this, which is that it really is a zero-sum game. There is no such thing as freedom and equality for everyone. The freedom of a few elites must be predicated upon the non-freedom of others.
That was historically, but that's one of the things she's talking about with the rise of technology and the change of the human condition, and that we can be relieved from this. And it's not clear that
properly free ourselves.
So robots lives.
Pretty much. But it's not clear that even, you know, is it have to be all or nothing? I have to be completely free from the cares of material. Even if things are being, I've got a government stipend, I still have to physically put the food in my mouth. Like there's stuff that you still have to do. There's labor.
There's IV.
I think the stipend should be big enough that there are people to do that for
you. Just eat the stipend. But it just seems that it has to reach a critical mass so that labor does not take so much of your energy that you don't have time to do philosophy and engage in politics and this kind of stuff. And it seems a reasonable goal that we could aim at that for everybody.
And we always are dissatisfied when we read a great critique that doesn't have a solution, right? That's a common problem in philosophy. But she starts off by saying, until we can talk about what's actually going on, right? She's going to speak this so that we have something that we can share in common and in our plurality come together as equals to solve. If she tried to give us a prescription, it would just be her. So this is a way to kick off the dialogue.
She's the only free one.
Well, all right, her last chapter that we didn't read is Life as the Highest Good. So there you go.
There's the answer.
Yeah, we don't even read it.
No, but that's actually a critique of life as the highest good. Yeah. it's actually saying...
Life as necessity is not the highest good.
Yeah, skimmed away.
It's the victory of animal labyrinths. Yeah. It's the unfortunate condition of modern life.
See, the
that life is the highest
growth
good.
Of the natural, Mark.
Yes, yeah. It's bad, Mark.
Well, speaking of bad, I'm sure people who are more familiar with this have been biting their tongues for a while. Justin, do you want to come be the mic carrier?
First of all, I want to say this is really great because a lot of people are watching this. They can see it. A group of people can sit down with the text and talk about it in a way that's serious, where discoveries are made, and you thoroughly enjoy yourselves doing it. I think that's excellent. My question, it's been a long time since I read this book, but I remember when I read it, I did love it. It's been so long, I've forgotten a lot of it. But, you know, Marx makes a distinction between the sphere of freedom and the sphere of necessity. And the idea of sphere of freedom, that's where politics are and philosophy and everything else. The sphere of necessity, there's really no way to take care of that. You just make it. Well, the modern way is to say, okay, we'll have technology take care of it. We'll develop our technology. We'll only have to work a half hour a day, and the rest of the day we can do whatever we want, which is, I think, a great solution. But there's another one, too, and I'm wondering how Arendt figures into this one. And that is, you know, we had the idea of the action and then work and then labor. If you have democratization of the workplace, remember for Marx, labor power includes the organization of the workers. And if that organization is a democratic one, where the workplace is thoroughly democratized, then doesn't that convert labor and work into action? And would that be another solution besides a technological one? Although that would be the easier path, a technological one. But the idea is then that the work is meaningful because you're interacting with all the other people working there, making decisions together, and that's part of the work. It's not just something laid onto it because it's the organization of labor. I don't know if she says anything about that in there. I can't remember.
Well, she does say, so if the government as a whole, you know, yes, we're getting together as equals, but we're getting together as equals to figure out how we can best manage our resources. That sounds like a democratic workplace. That's still not authentic political action. You have to have already taken care of the providing for yourself and not be mere administrators. But we still have this question of like, well, what are you supposed to do? You're just supposed to debate philosophy? Which other countries to invade? What?
Because it's not. I mean, it is administration, but it's a democratic form of administration.
Yeah.
That's
the same as my point about entrepreneurs. It seems like even these things that are for necessity, couldn't you do them in some way that seems meaningful? I think it's an empirical question. I think you'd go ask somebody. One of the critiques that I read of this, what's wrong with socialism, is does the experience of, this is from the Fritjof Bergman episode, does the experience of the factory worker get any better if that worker owns part of the factory? It's the same like horrible, demeaning thing that they're doing minute after minute, day after day. Why would that be any better by having a little sense of ownership about it? But maybe having the democratic structure means that nobody would have that horrible job anymore, that you'd actually raise working conditions. So it does seem like you could make tangible progress.
I think also, in the same way Wes pointed out, that her notion of the political is kind of hard to pin down, but no matter how you triangulate on it, it's very impoverished. It's very narrow and strict. But she does explicitly say that the political was the realm of the creation of immortality, right, through speech and deeds. So when you say democratized environment, you think of democracy because you're thinking ancient Greece, but that wasn't a democracy in the sense of like we're all equals, we all have one vote. It was, we can all come together, but my goal is still to be better than these guys. Right? I want to be more articulate. I want to be a better general. I want to do something to make myself stand out. So I don't know if that would fit what the model you were talking about.
So thank you for this. I love this book as well, and I really enjoyed hearing you talk about it. Just one quick comment to kind of save our performers over there. Arendt does says that the theater is the political place par excellence, I think, later on. So I think that she would say that something like performance is more political than something like labor or work. But I did have a question because it seems like there is a kind of separation between vita contemplativa and vita activa in that sense. And I was wondering if you could comment a little bit on the kind of relationship between the two. Because in the book, right, the point is to think what we are doing. So it seems like she's already kind of operating on a kind of relationship between those two kinds of life.
But she would say vita contemplativa is thinking about thinking. And so she's thinking about action here. And so she's using that power to do this, but she's not thinking about thinking. In fact, I think she almost says exactly
that. Well, she says something about it's not that man is the rational animal, but the speaking animal. And it's a kind of speech closely associated with action.
Yes.
So I think when we think what we're doing, it's that type of thinking. I think you put it very well, as opposed to, I think it's something different, I think, than contemplative thinking.
Yeah, she says actually explicitly about comparing those two forms of life, that the vita activa, the goal is immortality, whereas in the vita contempliva, the goal is the eternal. Mm-hmm. And she says the vehicle for the first is logos, and the vehicle for the second is nous. And nous cannot be translated into speech. The eternal cannot be spoken. So I thought the way I read this was that she was saying this is something that the philosophers invented because they weren't in on the vita activa. It was like a resentment move. And she was like, they claimed that they were attached to the eternal, and then they gave it a higher priority because they weren't engaged in the vita activa. And if you weren't engaged, they weren't fully human. They didn't have any power. That's kind of how I read that section. But it's very sort of patchy.
But I've worried about, again, this relationship between philosophy and the political, that it seems if the political is not about group housekeeping and how are we going to alleviate poverty, then it seems entirely sensible that it could get into an actual philosophical discussion. Like when we had Michael Sandel on, he didn't seem to have any sort of sharp distinction between doing philosophy and arguing about what we should do in the public realm. He, in fact, thought that what this conversation about democracy should be is like, what is justice? And the kind of thing that Socrates asked.
Right, but the political is the realm of action, and the goal of action, you're trying to get people to act, you need to be persuasive. The truth doesn't matter. That's why rhetoric is important in the political realm. You're basically trying to convince a bunch of people to do something, go to war, not go to war, change a policy, enact a law. And that's a lot different than Plato's vision of what the how the philosophical and the political would coincide.
But if her recommendation is that we need to think about what we're doing, so in other words, in the political realm, we need to actually, you know, what goes into actually thinking whether we should have genetic engineering? It seems that bringing in stuff related to, well, what is a person and things like philosophical issues is entirely on point. That doing it right means actually you do care about truth. You do try to not just convince people, but convince people based on what you take to be the truth.
Yeah.
Based on what your actual perspective of the multiple perspectives of the thing that make up reality. If the multiple perspectives were all just people egoistically putting themselves forward, those wouldn't be authentic perspectives on a shared reality. They have to be your reporting, your apprehension of the truth.
I don't disagree with that, but there's a huge difference between saying you can be thoughtful and think about something and climbing out of the cave, right? I don't have to have had an experience of the good to be thoughtful about political matters. I mean, I think this is the bias of philosophy. You're taking the Platonic stance, which is to say, I'm doing something wholly other and special, and because I'm able to grasp this eternal thing, you guys should come to me for answers.
So you have a narrow definition of what contemplation means, which I think is probably the traditional,
You know me, I'm just going by what I read.
Yeah.
It's not, that's my, and by the way.
No, I'm just saying,
there should be a reformation of
I think both of these points stand. It's just a matter of yes, if we
but
mean
we're
by
supposed to be responding
sorry,
to the
yes.
audience.
And by the way, for the performance artist, I came away with the same idea you did, that the truly political act is to do something completely one-off, useless, unreplicatable, and abnormal. That's what we should be doing.
Non-normative,
yes.
So I think it's kind of on this point that you were just talking about. So the task of thinking what we're doing, right? And I'm kind of thinking about post-structuralism and I'm thinking about psychoanalysis, right? And it's like inability to ever think fully what it is that you're doing, right? This kind of like wish to make everything present. And A, is it possible to actually fully, whatever that would mean, to really fully think what you're doing? Although it could be maybe like retrospective, like you can think about something that you're doing, but never actually pull it all present. And then the value of maybe not being able to think what you're doing, to not always have to live in that. Like, I don't know.
Right.
What
I'm pretty sure she was not talking about it on an individual level.
Well, I think psychoanalysis is a good example because it's what we do when we're not thinking what we're doing is we're acting out. It's a failure of mentalization. And the goal for Freud was to take unconscious thoughts and make them conscious, associate them with affects. In a way, it's very similar to be able to say what we're doing or say what we're feeling or those sort of things.
So. But do you think that she was understanding the political as being thinking what you're doing? I thought she was understanding her own activity as thinking what you're doing, but the active life would be one of action and not necessarily. I mean, where thinking goes in there, it's not at all clear to me.
Yeah, she has this very, very narrow notion of the political where there's a bunch of individuals that are like trying to decide, should we build this thing or not, right? The idea of creating policy, which does require evidence and knowledge and thought and theory and behavioral science and a variety of other things, and you get to a point, to use like the economic language, right? You have imperfect knowledge, but you have to make a decision, right? That's the world of the political. At some point, you have to make a decision because you have to do something, even if that's doing nothing. And so there's a place for thought and evidence and things like that in there, but there are strict boundaries on it.
I took thinking as, again, associated with speech, and again, where speech and action sort of go together and are part of the political side. I would favor the side of thinking of what she's doing as...
And speech and action going together is a matter of like them having the same Greek word. We didn't even talk about her whole goofy Heideggerian thing with words, that a lot of her justification for these things is like, well, if you look at the ancient Greek word, you can see that private actually, you know, has, look at the word private, it's like privative, it's bad, you know, that's a lot.
You have such contempt for this.
he hates the language stuff. I actually was going to ask you, Dylan, about some of the Greek things, just to see if they were completely off base.
You should ask Wes, he remembers more Greek than I do.
Did we address your question fully? Or?
I mean, it's close. I mean, you said something about saying being able to say what you're doing.
Yeah.
I was just thinking about it.
But you don't have the mic, so you didn't authentically actually even say that. Marilyn, go ahead.
Okay, so I don't know if she put this in a footnote or not, but I want to go back to her analysis of the household and the taking over of the social with the Roman world and, you know, the translation of, you know, political animal into the social animal. It seems to me there's an implicit critique of Stoicism in this. even though Stoicism has its origins in the Greek language, and it was still in the Hellenistic world, and it became very popular in Rome and in the Roman world, became the most popular philosophy. And the Stoic ethics basically has this notion that you start from the household. You know, you start your ethics from your interaction with your family. You establish ethical relationships within the family, and you extend that outward. You extend it out to your neighbors, and then to the polis itself, and then to the cosmos itself. So this was the aim of the Stoic sage, and this was the concept of oikeosis. So in Greek, oikos, you know, is where we get the word economy, and it basically means the house, or the household. So if the Stoic sage is going from this familial relationship and extending that out as the model of ethics to interact with the polis, if the household itself is the area of violence, which it is for Eric, you know, where, you know, you have a head of a household and you have the rest of the household, which is basically mute, doesn't have a voice of their own. I wonder if she's consciously or unconsciously looking at the Stoicism that is behind this spread of the social and the concept of society.
She doesn't say anything
about it. Bravo!
I don't know. Although it occurs to me, you know, Stoicism is also about this relationship to necessity. And the Stoic solution is to deny the relevance of necessity at all, right? The moral relevance, the relevance to happiness and flourishing. So for rent, you need the necessities to be taken care of by someone else to be free. For the Stoic, your freedom is inner. The point you made, it didn't occur to me, but it seems like that's a good point.
You know, I feel a little responsibility to the people in Australia and whoever have been watching this and posting on YouTube. Aaron, do we have any comments? No comments. Okay. You're all satisfied. Well, fine, live people. Any more?
I thought I remember her talking about the oikos piece. I can only find the stuff about the paterfamilias and the dominus, talking about the room. Yeah,
see, I don't remember mentioning Stoics either.
She does also talk about translation of lex, using the rule of law when you get into the Roman world and how that, but nothing specifically about the Stoics.
She does mention something about the Stoics in there at some point in the book, she's like, to say that I'm happy while a weight is crushing my chest is to be completely out of touch with what it means to be alive. Anyway, my question though, going back to what you guys were talking about earlier with democracy and competition and how we might be reading democracy as we understand it onto here unfairly, I'm kind of wondering about that. She does say that political activity, when it happens, it only happens among equals. The society is extremely unequal and it's predicated on slavery and all this stuff, but where political activity actually happens, it can only happen when there are equals and when they are citizens. So in that sense, I think that political activity is democratic. So what you're saying, I think, Mark, you're saying this, as far as competing against one another, is it really about trying to be the best then, if we're all equals? She does talk a lot about excellence in there. So, I mean, when you're doing political action, you want to do something great, but I'm not necessarily sure it means you want to be better than the others. That seems like it might create a tension between actually being able to speak to each other and experience the same reality if you're trying to one-up them and sort of occupy this different plane of existence, maybe?
I don't know. It does make sense, but I'm pretty sure she says it's exactly in section five.
She does say that, yeah, they're peers, but they have this agonistic, competitive relationship.
That's a good word. I like that word.
Agonistic.
Yes.
Agonist struggle. The reason why there's room for excellence in that struggle, so to speak, or contention amongst equals, is that you have the opportunity of recognition of your excellence by the others. So when the equals, if you outperform in theory, they will go, I acknowledge that you did a better job. I think in terms of the, you know, like a Homeric heroes, right? They're all great warriors, right? And they strive to distinguish themselves in battle. And I think that's kind of what's underlying that picture. But I do want to make a point of what we think of when we use the term equality, and this equality that existed in the polis are two very different things. We have a society of unequals that have equal rights. They had a society of equals as they perceived it, or at least more so equals in that sense. It was not a rights issue. So when we think of equality, we aren't thinking that we're equals. We're thinking that we have certain equal protections under the law, or maybe a certain dignity that comes through divinity or wherever that gives us all a certain something.
Just a quick follow-up. So when action does happen, it's when something really excellent happens. Someone does something better than anyone else could possibly do it. I mean, what function does that action have really politically? Can you guys think of something? Like, what good is that doing? Is that just like Bill Gates is, you know, making Windows and that's so awesome? Like, how is this different? Why is this
better? Well, but he particularly is not participating in it. He just is doing it because he can, not participating in a democratic process or, you know, in a deliberative process and convincing other people to, yeah, what is the point?
This goes to the problem of not knowing exactly what action is, but she does. I think On Revolution is the book that she wrote after this one.
On Violence. On Violence, On Revolution.
So she does say it somewhere that the paradigmatic political action is revolution. That can't be the only one.
I think if you made a great speech that you convinced the polity to take a particular action, that would count.
So it could be about like some sort of self-determination that they all decide on?
We should no longer have the Redskins as our mascot. That's the thing. We should put the flag up over there.
Setting every example we've come up with is
terrible. Does anybody know anything?
What about Solon's speech, right? What about that?
Which one?
Solon? Is that chopping the goat in half?
Solon or
Solomon, okay.
Or Pericles?
Yeah.
Solon.
Solon and Pericles.
Name dropping some Solon. Come on. Are we winding down here? Anybody else got some enlightenment to spread upon us? Your fellows. Aaron has a question. He's not just a man, but he's.
No, it's my question. Oh,
okay. People out in the world are useless. Actually, they're atemporal. They'll have questions later.
That or they don't know how to do it on the technology that we have.
So in the sort of the beginning part of the conversation, you were talking about the example of quantum mechanics, the example of scientists being unable to influence action because they've lost the power of speech, because their words are too precise, let's say, or in mathematical.
According to her, the diagnosis is that they cannot say what they're doing.
Yeah.
They have know-how, but without being able to say what they're doing.
Is that one extreme example where quantum mechanics is not very easily definable to the layman of what's going on, but it's not really like day-to-day, unless you're a conspiracy theorist who thinks that, you know, there's a particle accelerator is going to produce a black hole to kill everyone, that it's not really a danger. But you could go down the scale and say something like climate science or something where it's not, you know, I think people here are smart enough. They're not, but maybe not everyone in the political realm is intelligent enough to look at the evidence and to understand it, where you need scientists now who are like popularizing it and trying to talk it down a little bit. Is that like allowing scientists to enter that realm a little bit more, let's say?
I mean, the example that comes to my mind would be something like genetic engineering or GMOs or stuff. The criticism that you hear of GMOs partly amounts to, we don't know what the consequence of this will be, what are the unintended consequences. And to me, that's a way of formulating her criticism of scientists as being the improper speakers for these inherently political things, is that they can't say what actually they're doing and what the implications are.
Okay.
That's the kind of example that comes to mind. No,
they can't say, not the fact that their speech isn't, it's not like you can't, I don't want to say dumb it down, but you can't, you know, it's very technical and not very, whatever the opposite of that.
Would it work in the political realm? Could you get the science up there in front of Congress to explain clearly enough that everybody will be able to say, well, my scientist says something else. You know, no, there would actually be some consensus in action.
Yeah.
And she only talks about this for a short period of time, but I think she has in mind the idea that you can write down and do things that are unspeakable in a very straightforward sense. Like to do a calculation in mathematics and then try to speak what you're doing. Like in the speaking for her really is making sounds. Writing doesn't count as speaking for her.
Does that follow with, maybe because I misinterpreted that, because I was thinking that they couldn't like articulate that. Well, does philosophy suffer from the same thing? You know what I mean? That's where you are speaking so precisely in a mathematical formula or abstractly to where it does not have the same influence on action because it is so inarticulable, let's say.
That's a very good.
That's where rhetoric comes in, though. That's why when politicians want to convince you that this bill should go through, they don't talk to you about the details of the Affordable Care Act. They go, I visited Janine.
Yeah.
She's a mother of six in Georgia. And they tell you a story.
Yeah, and this is just bad rhetoric. I mean, imagine what it would be like.
It's easier to pull on heartstrings than it is to do the groundwork and go through and build up, okay, here's the arguments and here's why. It's a lot easier to just pull on somebody's heartstrings.
Right, so rhetoric traditionally for the ancients was a combination of appeals like that with reason. So
yeah,
it's not just, that's pandering.
Anecdotes is plus PowerPoint.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why I am not a professional philosopher, but I really do appreciate what you guys do. Part of the beauty of what you guys do, I think, is taking something like this, where I spent like a month trying to get into this and read it, and you know, I had other stuff going on, it's very difficult, but then this discussion really clarified it for me. Maybe for me, that's not a big deal, it's not going to cause any action to happen, but maybe for somebody else, it might. So, thank you.
Thank you for that, I will point out that we're not professional philosophers either, so there's hope.
So if you do something, yeah, it's like not being lawyers or doctors. Don't take our advice.
I just wanted to add one thought to what you've just been talking about in regard to science and scientific debate. I think the issue in the 50s was a matter of scale, size, at which things were occurring. To talk about splitting an atom or to talk about energy bands and an atomic configuration, that's unreal. And I think to use an analogy to what you talked about before, about in order to define reality, you had to, a group of people had to be able to come together and look at something and say, that's true, and we can agree on the aspects of it, and therefore we can say it's real. With quantum mechanics, it's a statistical process, it's not a deterministic one, so that's hard to really agree on. And it 0.901 at that size, in meters, for instance, you can't visualize that. It's not possible to really have a common ground with which to define reality. I think that's where the problem with talking about science in that era, I guess it's still with us, but that's largely due to that.
Yeah, we earlier were talking about the interpretive problems with quantum mechanics. It seemed like they must be in the background a little bit for her, which still do persist.
There's another example. Not long after this, when is Silent Spring? When it's like that's kind of like the birth of the first major environmental concerns, too, where things are happening that you can't see and you can't understand, but it took a Herculean effort by essentially a non-scientist, right, to change public opinion and change the policymakers. And so that's a non-mathematical version of, I think, the same problem.
I think at this point, maybe we take our last question. Does that sound good with you guys?
Sure.
Sure. If revolution is Arendt's definition of political action, authentic political action, and you would pose the question, what sort of speech might be there that would make that happen? What would she consider of the gentleman in Tunisia, the fruit seller, who had had his fruit cart confiscated and then decided to go in front of a government building and self-immolate and caused an enormous amount of upheaval that is still reverberating through Syria and such.
Yeah, that doesn't seem like a political act of conversation to me. And so I don't understand. I'll take your word for it that revolution has to be something to do with what she's recommending. But I find it hard to understand.
Well, it's not the only kind of action.
But if you're saying that the only... What is a revolution against? Against this system in which we are having an egalitarian discussion? That's what you'd have to be rebelling against, but that would undermine the whole process of talking itself. So I don't understand.
Well,
most of your questions is that we don't.
But this particular case, I feel like she would consider that not... In a funny way, she would consider not a political act because it wasn't speech. I think she's very serious about speech being actual vocalizations and going out and talking, especially later in the book. Now, maybe she's more subtle about it than that, but...
I don't know. I mean, doesn't that count as a kind of speech?
I want to say that it is, because it seems like it is, but I don't...
It's an action and speech.
Well, that would be... It's an open question to me based upon the other stuff that I read about.
I don't know either,
how seriously she means to take speaking. And then in that particular case, I want to say that he's sort of displaying his freedom very decisively, But under the criteria of the way she's talking about freedom, she doesn't talk about freedom being exactly that way. I think it's a good question about how she would think about it.
I hope that our listeners don't choose that path, but instead become good spactivists and talk about...
Spactivists?
Yes, speech and action are the same thing. And talk about all the stuff that should be done. There you go.
Not ages. And
I think we're now done. We've reached some consensus that is what is going to happen.
All right, please join me in applauding Partially Examined Life.
Thank you, and good night. Yes. Thank you, good night. Just say good night.
Good night.
Good night. Good night.
Thank you for coming.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank
All right,
you.
We'll be around. Chat with us.
I can feel you tonight. Your warmth lurks in this room. It's a rush and repeat. Like a beautiful tune, you've affected my life unbelievably much, and I don't think I even feel like killing and such. And I love this space in front of me, and I love this place embracing me, 'cause you're in it, yes, you're in it. Every day I get up about 3 hours late, after lying there seething with you, my omnipresent mate. Even though you're not physically here, I'm convinced that you're not only near, but you've claimed this place as your identity. And whenever I'm in it, you're practically me. And I love this space in front of me, and I love this place confronting me, 'cause you're in it, yes, you're in it, yes, you're in it. Though I truly believe that you're normal and real, you persist in this place stronger than I can feel. When I scrub the toilets, you moan with delight. If I mow the lawn, can I edge you goodnight? And I've fallen in love with this magical house, and I hope you come home, my omnipresent spouse. And I love this space in front of me, and I love this place confronting me, 'cause you're in it, yes, you're in it, yes, you're